Hello, my name's Therese Sweeney. Welcome to my podcast, Therese Makes History, Season 1, The Dairy Lane Project. Today, Episode 7. This project is assisted by Turfco in Jasper's Brush, operating for 40 years and the largest agricultural employer in the region. Thank you, Gavin Rogers. I've also secured support from McGoldrick Real Estate, operated and owned by Tim McGoldrick and family. They've been in Berry since 1987. Tim specialises in lifestyle properties, homesteads, cottages, and homes in the region. Your support is appreciated, Tim and Gavin, toward this important digital history archive. Dairying was the primary industry throughout the Shoalhaven in the 20th century. In Season 1 to date, I've been engaging descendants of pioneers in the lanes named in their honour throughout Maru Meadow. Dairy people, residents now ageing who carry the memories of their pioneering relatives and reflect on their own farming lives. I've gone a bit rogue this episode. I've discovered a terribly important family that have migrated all the way from Norway. Their story is dairy related, and it needs telling. It's an important piece of this puzzle we're putting together. Hans Jorgensen, S-O-N is the last three letters, was a sailor who travelled around the world from the mid-19th century. He jumped ship on a boat to Australia and arrived in 1879 from England. He eventually settled at La Hogue in Robertson in the Southern Highlands. He married Harriet Mansfield in 1883. They had eight children, four boys and four girls. Hans stayed living in Robertson. One of their sons, known as Bert, who was born in 1893, went to school with Gus Miller's dad, William, at Robertson. Perhaps this may have influenced Bert's move to Berry. Bert left Robertson with two bullocks named Nobby and Comet and a dray. He came skidding down Berry Mountain as he'd taken the wheels off the axis of the dray because it was so steep and he didn't want to lose the bullocks. That's how he arrived in Berry. The Miller family became his adopted family, and they became close with the Jorgensen family to this very day. They took Bert under their wing. Bert became well known and was a clever businessman. He ran a big bullock team and carted logs to the mills. He'd load up down at the railway. Bert is responsible for putting up all the power poles in Berry. He did this physically himself with the bullocks. He made a considerable amount of money digging out cedar stumps, roots and all. He'd then sell them off to Sydney. Furniture makers would slice them up, veneer them for furniture. Bert played rugby for the Berry All Blacks before World War I. He then switched to rugby league for the Berry Magpies during World War I. Rumour has it he kept his first milk check and he's still looking for the $5 he lost down the main street. Apparently someone picked it up and was shouting everyone at the pub. He wasn't too happy about it when he found out. So now I bring you to Episode 7, The Jorgensens Buried a Bomadary. Today I'm interviewing Ian Jorgensen, who grew up in Bomadary and worked in the dairy industry from age 17. Hi, Ian. How are you today? Thanks for joining me here.
Thanks, Therese. Thanks for having me. And I want to thank you for doing this podcast because, you know, you go back into your memory of mind, you think of your memory as being a bit of a hard drive. Well, unfortunately, I was born before hard drives were invented. We go back to probably books. So with listening to your podcast, I've gone in and I've found these old dusty books that are in my mind. And the minute I opened it up, it turned colourful. and it brought back great memories of the dairy farms, the farmers. My early years as a little kid in Bomadery, which we'd like to call a bomber.
So tell me, Ian, what is your year of birth and where were you born?
Yeah, 1959. I was born up in Junction Street. It's now the Drug and Alcohol Rehabilitation Centre called Oolong House. And, that's where I was born.
So you were born at Oolong House. What was it prior to Oolong?
It was a hospital, a maternity section, I think, there at, for women to go and have their kids.
Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a brother, Barry. He's 6 years older than me. We're very close, which is great.
And your parents' full names, and do you know their year of birth?
It's Norman Albert Jorgensen was my dad, and Grace Elizabeth Wallace. No, I don't know their full dates of birth.
Are they still alive?
No, unfortunately, my mum passed away a couple of years ago, and my dad, I think, around 15 years ago, and miss him dearly.
Yes. How do you spell your last name?
Jorgensen, which is unusual because most Norwegians spell their name S-E-N.
How far back, because I come across your name quite a bit, so how far back is your family connection to this region?
It was the late 1800s when my great-grandfather turned up in Sydney. He was a Norwegian seaman and worked on merchant ships, and the story I've been told that I think basically around about 13 years old, he worked on ships and he'd been around the world two or three times. He came back, I think, when he was in his teens and saw his mother for the last time, and he gave her a China doll from China, set sail, never to return back to Stavanger in Norway, got to Australia. The story is, could have jumped ship, probably not. Apparently he got on well with the captain, decided he wanted to make a new life in Australia. And that's, so his family had never heard of him, or they didn't know what happened to him. And basically he disappeared. My cousin, Elaine King, who was researching the family, and she didn't know really a lot about Hans, just other than he come from Stavanger. So she wrote some letters to the local newspaper. And when she wrote, and the newspaper did a story on it, there was no response.
When was that? Do you know?
That would have been in the 70s. And
when you say a local newspaper, what newspaper?
Oh, the newspaper in the Stavanger. Okay. One of my relatives from Norway went to the shop. And as you know, and sometimes you buy drinks and cold things, they'll wrap something up in newspaper. So she went home to the rest of the family, and they were just talking in the kitchen. And while they were talking, this relative of mine was unwrapping this, and she was reading the newspaper. And she said, "We've found Hans." And the rest of the family said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "He's in Australia." So, we had a family connection then. A heap of Norwegians visited us, actually in Bomadery and Bury.
When was that?
That was 1980. It was so funny because they were coming to our winter and they all had fur coats on, and these coats were unbelievable. They were full on like bear coats, I don't know, furs. So they, but they couldn't believe our winter that we had flowers. My cousin has been over there, both my cousins, my wife and I have been to Stavanger and went to the old town. It's beautiful, beautiful.
And your two cousins, what are their names that you reference?
Elaine King and Alan Hitchcock. So Elaine and Alan are brother and sister.
And Elaine was a Hitchcock.
That's correct.
And married a King.
That's the way, yeah.
So is that King a farmer?
No.
What did they think of the place, your Norwegian relatives? Just briefly, what did they think of the landscape?
Oh, they loved it. And the main thing was that they couldn't believe, my mother was an avid gardener with flowers. And, they loved it, to see the flowers out in winter, and basically it was like their summer.
And the coastline.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, yeah.
Would have blown their mind.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, they all travels themselves. Some of their parts of their family, they lived in Canada and different parts of the world. So, it was wonderful. And it was wonderful for Rhonda and myself to go to Stavanger. I just couldn't believe how beautiful Norway is.
So we'll just briefly, you're mentioning Rhonda. So Rhonda is your wife. What's her former name?
She's a Neville. They moved to Nowra from around the 1960s for not really local people. Sydney, they were around the Canterbury area, went out west and out around Boorowa, and then came back down and settled in Nowra.
In a house or a farm?
Just in a house.
And what about your children? Do you have children?
Yeah, I have two. Yeah. I've got Matthew, my oldest boy. He lives in Sydney and works in the field of research. And which is more to do with business and advertising. And my youngest son, Dylan, who runs our business.
Just getting back to Hans. So when did Hans arrive? And do you know the boat or ship?
He arrived in 1879. Ended up in Robertson. He met his wife, Harriet Mansfield. They had farms and properties, I believe. And how he ended up actually in Bury and down this way, I'm not sure.
It was he the beginning of the lineage here?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct, yeah, yeah. He was mainly involved in, labouring type work. I believe the whole south coast was timber, so they were cutting trees, out around Harley Hill and down in the Shoalhaven area. So, a lot of people worked in the timber industry or the dairy industry.
Because I've seen an old bullock whip, I think, that was at Bury Museum. They put a picture out and they had his name, I think, attached to it.
Yeah, no, that was his son, Bertel Jorgensen. He was known in Bury as Bert or Nobby Jorgensen. He was one of the local identities. He would become quite successful. He bought a lot of properties. He made a lot of money with his bullock team. It was right up until just before he passed away. I took him. He had a farm up at Bury Mountain, and I took him up to the farm there, and he could still, we left our car, walked across the paddocks. It was a beautiful farm. It overlooked Kangaroo Valley, and it was on Irvine's Lane, and he whistled, and to my amazement, all these bullocks ran out of the bush over to him. He was a bullock driver.
How old would he have been when that happened?
He would have been well into his late 80s, yeah.
And when did he pass?
Yeah, not long after that. Yeah.
How many children did Hans have?
I've got the list there, and I'm thinking around about four or five, yeah.
Are there any more stories relating to Hans or his children that you recall?
No, not really. The only person really I had anything to do was Bert, and we all had a fairly close relationship with the Jorgensens. So, it was good. I used to come over with my parents and visit him, and
Because there's a few Jorgensens around, aren't there, still today? So you went to a funeral recently.
My cousin. Yeah,
okay. So let's just briefly talk about that person, because that person made quite a contribution, I think, from what I gathered.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
What was his name? And
he was only about a month difference in age from my brother, so he was quite young when he passed away. John was a builder, an absolutely great guy, well known in the Bury and Shoalhaven area. He was involved in horses, and he also showed dogs. And he was a very, very good builder. He built luxury homes, and I was lucky enough to do some jobs with him. And unfortunately, he developed a dementia type disease young. Well, I think he would have been probably only around late 50s, early 60s. And unfortunately, he passed away from that disease. And his father was my father's brother, and they worked at the Nowra Dairy Company for combined years, probably 100 years between them.
Let's talk about your father and his siblings as well. So he's got that brother.
Yeah, he has. He's got his brother, Bill, and then he had sisters. They all got married, or a lot of them did, to local farmers. Nellie, she was married to a Turner. Edna to a Turner. Rainey to a Vaughan, Vaughan's farm, which is next to Pat Muller's farm. Rita, she was married to a Buchan, who was a mechanic.
So where's the Hitchcock name come in?
The one I forgot, Auntie Eileen. She was a lovely lady. Auntie Eileen, she was married to Tom Hitchcock. So Tom Hitchcock, I believe, was the son of Tom Hitchcock, who was the farmer who had the property out there at Maru, where I think you'd spoke to Pat Muller about the Maru Hall was on Tom Hitchcock's farm. Dad and Uncle Billy, they both previously left school when they were quite young, and they worked on their sister's husband's farms. Then eventually they got jobs at the Narra Dairy Co-op, and they worked there for a combined 50 years each there. Now their jobs.
And when did they start there? Do you know roughly?
No, that would have been I know my dad was in his early teens, and across the road from the dairy factory, there was a place called the Casein Factory. Now, casein, I believe, is something to do with starch or bread, all I remember as a little kid, it used to stink, and I used to hate the place. An interesting story, my dad would have been probably there when he was about 13, 14, and then eventually, it was hard work. The bosses were in those days quite unfair. Even some of the staff that worked there, the older men, were somewhat bullies to the kids. Anyway, one day a guy turned up and he said, "I'm from the union," and he spoke to my dad about the working conditions. So my dad joined the union. So that lasted one day, and he was instantly sacked. The funny part about it, which it's amazing now when you think about it, you know, imagine a young boy going through this in, say, the 1940s around the wartime. The union took his employer to court. So my dad, as a young boy, went to court and he was instantly reinstated.
And he stayed there for 50 years.
Yeah, he stayed there, and the conditions changed, of course. It was ended up being a wonderful place to work. The Narra Dairy Company, they looked, as time went on, probably with the involvement in the unions in those days, conditions got better. And, they were a wonderful employer to him.
It says something about your father, though, the courage to stay and to commit.
Oh, I was... Yeah, I couldn't believe, and I putting yourself in that place, I don't think I could have done what he did, and to have that strength to join the union, to be sacked and then go to court and come back, and it's unbelievable. But
where was it actually located, the Narra Co-op?
Yeah, in Bomaderry. I don't think anyone liked it being called the Narra Co-op. That in Bomaderry, we had this thing between Bomaderry and Narra, and
what was that?
Look, we were probably the poor cousins to Narra Bomaderry in those days. If my dad had his way, and he mentioned it plenty of times, that he would have cut down the Narra Bridge, and because he always believed that the people in Narra starved without Bomaderry, because we had the milk factory, we had the paper mill, and we had probably better ground, for growing veggies and that sort of thing. Oh, he was so upset when eventually Uluru Road was always called Uluru Road. They decided that Uluru Road might be better off named North Narra. And my father was livid. He had that many fights. He couldn't, he was just... Because the way he worked it out was the middle of the bridge. The south side was Narra. We owned the north side. That was Bomo. So he said that Uluru Road belonged to Bomaderry. And he was not very happy when it was named North Narra.
When you say they worked on their brother-in-law's properties, what were they doing there? Was that pre-mechanisation?
Oh, yeah. They were horses and ploughs and Kangaroo Valley in the winter. And, it was really, really tough and hard.
Who owned that property at Kangaroo Valley?
It would have been the Turners. Edna's or Nellie. husbands, yeah. They were brothers too, yeah.
Who was the Turner, do you know?
Yeah, Harry and Ernie.
They were grading milk, were they, the two brothers?
Yeah, that's correct. They were both milk graders. Yeah, it was a qualification. Dad could, by lifting a milk can lid, could smell or taste and pretty well know, he could work out what, especially if there was a bit of a strong taste, he could work out what the cattle had been eating. Sometimes there'd be employees of the factory would say, oh, this milk has to be thrown out, it's off. Call my dad in or Uncle Billy and they'd taste it and they say, no, they've just been on carrot weed or some sort of weed and it's, yeah, it has tainted the taste, but the milk is still good.
Where were they positioned in the factory? On, like, pretty much on arrival, or was it at the railway?
No, they, well, what happened, the trucks used to pull up and, people like Henry Werder and different people would unload the trucks and they had this chain conveyor belt and it used to take the cans up. My dad and Uncle Billy would be standing up there and it was a huge scale. So they'd, the cans had already been opened by usually someone like Henry Werder, and then they'd tip the milk into these big vats, and that was a scale. So they'd weigh the milk, and then they'd record that on a sheet of paper. But before they tipped it, they'd always smell the milk and make sure it was okay. Then after all those that farmer's cans were put through the scales, the milk was released and it went through the system. And they could always tell the farmers' cans because they were all decorated. And some farmers went to a lot of trouble. They used to either paint different coloured bands around. Someone would have coins soldered to it and polished. And a lot of farmers are really proud about their milk cans. And that was the way they identified them.
What were they weighing for? Is it the fat?
No, weighing the milk in quality. So, in other words, a litre of liquid is 1 kilo, or in those days would have been so many pounds. After putting, say, 23 cans through, it would be so many pounds. It'd be written down on a... they had these pencils, and it was a huge pad. And they...
When you say huge, because you're little,
yeah.
When you're looking at this...
It was probably something around a metre... meter long and
record book.
Yeah, big record book. Yeah. So when at the end of the day, they were taken to the office, and that's how the farmers were paid off those sheets.
Was there only two milk graders?
Yeah, I'm not too sure, but I knew Dad had the qualification. I'm sure there were some other guys there that had it too. And I suppose as long as they had someone there with that qualification, yeah.
We'll get back to the milk factory, because it was really highly regarded, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a wonderful milk factory, and the produce that they produced there, the butter was very of high quality.
Now, who was making the butter? You see men churning these. Tell me about what that looked like.
Yeah, well, when I was little, and again, you wouldn't be allowed to do it, but I was probably around 5 years old, and... I'd have free reign at the whole milk factory, so I knew everyone that worked there, and I used to wander, I'd wander down and into the butter area, and I used to love watching the big butter churn turn, and then it was on a big table, and it was a huge block, 4 or 5 metres long by probably 2 metres high, and then they'd have these big stainless steel wires with handles on it. Then they a man on each side, and they'd pull these handles through the butter, and that would cut the butter. And then they would make it into large cubes, that probably 20 kilo cubes, and then they would drop that into the machine. And that machine then would cut the butter into size. It would run along and put the Narra Dairy Co-op label on it. I think when I was there was a guy called Robert Everson. I think Robert was the boss of that section. Again, because of the quality, Robert had agricultural type training, so he had that qualification. Yeah, they were cardboard boxes when I was small. All the boxes, they were...
Conveyor belt,
and then the guys would put a box together and stack the box in the butter in manually. There was machinery in there to actually cut the butter into size and wrap it. A lot of the steam-driven equipment was still in the milk factory, but it wasn't used. There was a main drive that went through the factory, which was a great big metal bar, and it had pulleys off it. Now, that would have been, that was were probably before the war, and but they were still using two coal boilers there. Because of cleanliness, they used a lot of hot water and steam. My uncle, Tom Hitchcock, he was in charge of that, in charge of those boilers, and he had an offsider called Mike Wensick, and again, he was Polish like Henry Werder. They were responsible for all the mechanical stuff, because mainly things were mechanical. And then there was an electrical side, of course.
Do you call them boiler makers?
Yeah, they would have been. I don't know if they had that qualification, but basically they were boiler makers. And I used to love going out there because Uncle Tom and Mike were quite often, if I got there at the right time, they used to shovel the coal with these very wide-bladed shovels. Then every now and then, well, every day they would cook their meals on these shovels, and it was great. They'd have the fire open and these shovels in there with their bits of steak and tomatoes and eggs, anything you could cook. But I was always amazed, and I used to love watching.
Will we go to bottles?
Oh, yeah, no, the bottles were fine. As you know, all our through the 50s, 60s, everything came in bottles. They had a section there where the bottles were brought back in. With the old bottle, there was old bottles and new bottles. Old bottles were washed, new bottles were put in, and they had this bottling plant. So it was mechanised. It was quite modern. The bottles would go along, the right amount of milk, a pint or whatever would go in, and then they were capped, and then they were put in cool rooms or taken out to the vendors.
Tell us about the caps.
Yeah, the foil caps. It was on a great roll, and they had different colours. There was only one milk then. It was milk. They didn't have all the different types in those days. And then, but they had different caps for cream. So that they were in bottles as well, probably half pint bottles. The wonderful thing about these. The material, which was a coloured foil, brightly coloured foil. All the kids of our parents that worked there, we used to get the old rolls. And then it was, as you can imagine, like a 50 cent circular cutout on these foils. And again, like I said, in those times they were fairly tough. So we would take them to our schools and they'd decorate the schools with the offcuts from the mill caps for Christmas. So so all the classrooms had all these Narra Derry Co-op foil cutouts in different colours, and gave us a bit of a Christmas feel to our December at school.
And what colours were they?
Red was the one that really stuck out to me, and I think with cream it could have been yellow or green, I'm not too sure.
Silver.
Yeah.
Now, you're a young boy walking around Bombarderry, roaming around, because we had a lot of freedom. It was not like today, you know. You had a lot of freedom to explore in those factories. They kept an eye on you, but you knew the way it all operated.
Yeah, I probably started when I was about five, walking down, and I know my Uncle Billy's kids did it as well, you know. And
let's explore that in detail. Tell me about your walk and where you went from your house to.
Yeah, so we were brought up in Dalwar Street, which is two streets behind the main street in Bombarderry. And I'd walk down to the corner and then along, I think it's Tallyang Street. A bit like one of your previous speakers. We didn't know streets in those days. We just knew where everyone lived. So, yeah, and then I'd walk down past Donnie Sparrow's pub, and I used to eye off the old old spirit bottles, because they were empty, of course, out in the yard, but I used to love all these colours. And Don used to drive a Rambler, and that was a flash car, because not many people had cars in those days. And I'd walk past and I always saw him. He was always neatly dressed and he had this neatly groomed moustache, but he'd always say hello to me. And I'd cross Maru Street, which was the main street, and then I'd walk down a bit of a hill near the... there was a water tower there for filling up the steam engines then. It was still there, and they were still using the steam shunters. And then I'd wander across. I'd have a look, because Dad always said, watch out for trains, and I'd walk across about 10 lots of railway lines, and there was a little metal ladder. I'd climb up there past the produce. The produce store was which used to hold the hay, the grain and that for the farmers. So that was the other part of the Narrow Dairy Company business, co-op business. And then I'd walk down into the mill factory, and I used to do that quite often and just say hello to the workers on my way, and they used to smile, and it was a wonderful time.
And was that on your way to school or on the weekends or?
No, I don't think I probably wasn't at school. So it was probably before I was at school. And probably one of the most memorable memories I had when I was probably about four. Barry's my brother. He's 6 years older than me, so he would have been 10. He took me down up the other way, which is what I'd call north of Dawa Street, into Bumberra Street, down past the old Bumberra RSL, and down to the train line, to the train station. And on one particular day, the circus was coming to town. Oh, I've still got vivid memories. And to see the open rail trucks with the elephants on them, the elephants were just chained on the onto the rail trucks. Then they somehow must have caved on the southern end of the railway station there at Bomaderry. They'd coax the elephants off. All the animals that you didn't want to get near were in these big vans, which again would have been on rail trucks, and I'm assuming they were lifted off. They had this really, really old, wild-looking crane at the railway station then. I think it was even hand-driven, I don't know. They would have pulled these carts off. The part I had forgotten about, my brother told me, they'd actually hook the elephants up, pull these trailers over from Bomaderry, across the bridge, and near the swimming pool. I do remember they used to, a lot of times they'd unhook the elephants and they'd put the elephants in the river there, give them a wash and a cool down, and they'd walk their way up to the recreation park up near the hospital, and they'd be there for a few weeks and doing their shows. But also too...
So getting across the bridge with the elephants and the traffic would have stopped traffic.
Yeah, probably not a lot in those days.
Yeah, it's funny, people don't understand. There are people couldn't afford cars.
Yeah, that's right. Look, it would have been a minor inconvenience. I know there is a famous story about the elephant that laid down in the middle of the Narra Bridge and they couldn't get up. I wasn't sure what year or when that happened, but yeah, it did happen. They decided that this is it. So
I've had enough.
Yeah, I've had enough. I'm stopping for a while. And also too, and it would be hard for people to understand or believe, Bomaderry was actually black. So the railway station, all the shops, a few streets back, it looked horrible. Now, the black was from the soot from the shutters of the steam trains. All the carriages and everything used to come by train in those days, except for the only diesel engines in those days were the trains that took people to Sydney. It was the Red Rattler, and then that was replaced later with the Silver Train, they used to call it. Bomaderry just had this really... I can still remember this dark look, all the shops because of this soot. And then when they slowly changed over to full diesel, you could see it. It was just like someone was washing the town slowly, and all the colours came out. The old timber verandas that used to run along, it was a bit like the Western. You know, you had the old timber verandas with the old verandas out the top, and timber floor walkways, and that they were slowly replaced by the council into concrete, and so Bomaderry actually started to change.
Yes, that's a lot of change.
Mm.
Tell me about, the milk cans going to Sydney on the trains, what did that look like?
Well, no, they were in great tanks. So once they were rail cars or carts, or they were like a huge tank, stainless steel. They looked horrible on the outside. They were all black and horrible. But when you used to, you'd lift the lid up, they were full stainless steel inside. So the milk was, this is the excess milk sometimes, was stored. So they used to use a lot of the milk in Narra because it was sold locally into our milk bottles and whatever. And then they would send some milk away, and they would send that in these rail carts. And they used to travel, I think, in the early hours of the morning. I'm not too sure.
And they're going to the Sydney factories.
Yeah.
At Ultimo or wherever it might have been.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
So all your milk bottles at school, you had milk?
Yeah, we used to have that horrible hot milk, you know. It used to turn up unrefrigerated and we were forced to drink it. And yeah, I used to do everything I could to get away from it because it turned me off milk forever. It was disgusting.
You mentioned flavoured milk too. They'd give you some flavoured milk.
Yeah. Well, you know, touring the factory and quite often I'd be down in the butter room and Robert Everson or one of the employees, they, and again, wonderful people, and they'd go over to one of the cool rooms and ask me, you know, whether I want a chocolate or a malt or a strawberry milk, and yeah, they give me one of these half pint cartons or whatever they were, and they used to really look after us. They were a wonderful group of men. Yeah.
What were they wearing? Were different uniforms, different jobs?
No. Dairy Factory was always white, so they used to wear white overalls, white aprons, and white caps, and they were cotton gumboots. Yeah, they were all dressed in white, except the management. But, that was the way. Everything had to be kept clean and spotless, and it was.
What about the management? Do you recall any of the managers? Did you meet any?
I knew a bit. He was the foreman, a guy called Kevin Schubert. He was there many, many years. Management was different in those days. There was a guy called Bob Graham, and even the employees called him Mr. Graham. Now, Mr. Graham was over in another office and he used to have a full-time secretary who was always well-groomed. He had a big flash car. It was a different time in those days where, yeah, if you were in senior management, you were well-respected or not, but...
There was a status.
Oh, definitely a status, yeah, yeah. That was, like I said, they always had a big flash Chev car and... Yeah.
But all the dairy farmers were the shareholders, yeah?
That's correct, yeah. And it worked really, really, really well. A lot of successful farmers. I can mention many, many names of these farmers, and they were well-respected. And the Narra Dairy Company was very, very successful. You look at other co-ops, for example, like Bega. Now, if you go to Bega, if they didn't do their job better than anyone else, you would not hear of Bega cheese on all, and Bega's probably the great success story. But they had to be because they were isolated. They were isolated from Victoria and Sydney. So to produce milk in Bega, you had to be better than everyone else. And Bega is. And to that, still today, Bega owns Kraft. And I'm really pleased. I think they own the Dairy Farmers label, which is wonderful.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, them and Norco. Norco's up the North Coast. They're again, they'd be the two real success stories.
So the milk at Nowra was called Nowra Co-op?
That's correct.
Did it have a little anything, like some of the changes? When did it go from bottled?
Yeah, what happened is they bought out homogenisation. Now, everyone went crook about it. So you all remember you had a bottle of milk, you'd take the lid
when
off.
When was this?
This would have been late 60s, early 70s. So you had your milk bottles and we'd all open the milk bottle and whoever got it first, we'd get the big blob of cream and the rest of us would get white water. But no one really understood that. So they bought out homogenisation and my dad was involved in that and again through the process of milk. So what... All they did was get a stainless steel, a lot of wire, and they push it together. It was only small. It was very looked very much like if you looked at a football boot and the tag on the bottom of a football boot, the bit on the ground, one of those. So the milk was forced through that wire. What that did was separated the cream and pushed the cream through all the milk. So that way, if you were the first person to open the milk bottle, the last person, everyone got their fair share of cream. So that's how homogenisation. So around that time, I remember my dad went to Sydney to some show and they were looking at what the next change from bottles were and they brought out a lot of stuff from all over the seas. There were plastic bottles and different things and But Nara chose, they had a few things that went wrong. They used the plastic bag for a while, and every house had a little cradle to put that plastic bag. Wasn't overly successful, and then they went to the cartons, so carton milk, and eventually then they went to the plastic bottles.
You talk about three major changes in milk producing.
Yeah, well, probably...
Is this the bulk milk cartridge?
Yeah, around 1967, I think, bulk milk came in. It was a concern to people like my dad because they all worked in the milk factory. You had people that were going out and collecting the cans. You had the dairy farmers who had to go through the expense of putting these stainless steel tanks in. So it was an absolute huge change.
And was this with homogenisation around the same time? Because you've got the milkman.
Yeah, that's correct. So homogenisation was the first thing. And then they went to the milk tank, the tanks on the farms. And like I said, my dad was a milk raider. He was offered a job to drive one of the trucks because basically there was no other job for it. So my dad, Uncle Billy, they got into these trucks and, you know, they hadn't driven a lot of cars really in those days because, you know, I was probably, you know, 12 or 10 before we got our first car. So, yeah, they chucked in one of these big trucks. And that's what Dad and Uncle Billy did until they retired. They went out and collected the milk from the farms. My dad eventually ended up doing a coastal run. He used to go down to Badalla Cheese Factory down there. He used to take milk down for them, and then he would pick up milk around there for the farms and bring it back to Nara. So he loved that trip. He used to go down there. It was just he knew the road, the highway, and was happy to do it 7 days a week.
What did that mean for dairy farmers in terms of technology? And
huge! It was a huge change. Firstly, they had to extend their the dairy itself. They had to build another room. Most of them, they didn't have that room, so they had to put a room in there for the milk tank. They had to get power upgrades because they didn't have a lot of power available and they were only running the milking machine, so they had to have the power to run a compressor. Then they were responsible for sterilising those milk tanks, making sure that the tank was down to 3.5 degrees. That's when,
That would have had a huge impact on those farmers that...
Oh, some of them closed down. Yeah. It was a...
Because there's quite a cost involved in that.
Oh, yeah. So some farmers... A lot of the small farmers got out, the larger farms got bigger, and that's what happened.
Just backtracking, sorry, where you've got the charcoal boilers going to oil?
No, the coal, they were, you know, getting away from coal. Oil was cheap in those days, so they converted them to oil burners. It's a bit like the trains. They got rid of the coal trains and went to diesel trains.
So you remember the oil?
It was a lot easier for my uncle, because my uncle used to have to go down there, I don't know what time, and these things had to be kept alight all the time. And again, it's a bit like the steam engines. Without a fire, you don't go anywhere. So once they went to oil, it went to mechanisation, and they could control the boil through time as it continually ran, got up to temperature, shut down. Just had a pilot flame going, and then when the temperature needed, they were taking hot water away. They'd fire back up. Yeah, so it'd become a lot easier.
I want to go to you shortly in your profession, but just thinking of you as a young man, we walked everywhere in those days.
Hmm.
So what did Bomaderry look like? Is there any kind of, just thinking about Bomaderry, do you ever remember, was the Aboriginal mission there?
Yeah, it was great. Like Bomaderry, it was nearly all gravel roads. As we got older, we all got push bikes. So we spent a fair bit of time with skin hanging off us because there was quite a few hills and we'd lose our bike. We had gravel rash all over us. Mum used to get upset because my clothes would be torn. We lived in Dalwa Street, and it's not as steep as it is now because when they tarred it, they took a lot of the hill out of it. But when it was gravel, we had a great hill. So the billy carts would start off at just that in front of our place, because that's where the hill was. And then so everyone used to go down, and you'd put someone and watch on down near the Grimes's down the corner, because that was where the next intersection is. So even though cars didn't come along, so you'd fly down the hill. If you were lucky enough, you'd take the corner. If you didn't, you'd crash. But if you took the corner, you'd run down to what you call Frogsy, Frogs Hollow. So as small kids, we used to go down. It was a great place to explore. There was a few caves down there, and a few of the Aboriginal guys would sleep in the caves there. There wasn't a lot of houses. There was a guy called Bim Stewart lived on the corner, and his relatives, some of the Aboriginal people, used to stay there. And he was a wonderful guy. He followed the Bomaderry Rugby League, and then you'd walk up over the hill, and again, I'm not talking about great distance, you know, probably 100 metres up over some rocks, and the UAM home was there. And
what's the UAM? What does that mean?
United Aboriginal Mission, I think, and as we all learnt, was part of what they say and believe is the Stolen Generation. So we went to school with these kids, but we were all one. We had the same teachers. We mixed together, played football for Bomaderry, Swamp Rats in those days, and cricket, just mixed together, and there was nothing different. All we just knew that the kids, and we call it the home then, had some ladies that they used to, I think they call them sisters, and used to look after them, and that was it. There was no difference. And a lot of those guys and girls that went there are still in this area today.
So tell me about gravel. That's tough, isn't it? Did you have footpaths?
No footpaths. like I said, Bomo was pretty well gravel. They're just everywhere. I think in the early years, I think the main street might have been tarred, but other than that, there wasn't any real roads, and that was a great thing to see as time went on, to get some tar roads. It made it a lot easier.
It's interesting because there is the swamp there, isn't it? Just over the hill there into Bowalong.
Yeah.
So I love the name Swamp Rats.
Yeah, well, the football ground down the bottom, the old Bomaderry football ground, which was next to... It's a hardware store now, but that used to be Reed and Hearn Sawmill there. And the football ground there, there's the Bomaderry Creek runs behind it. So any of the goal kickers kicking the ball, a lot of times any of the guys that could kick a ball good, the ball ended up in the creek. And down in that creek there, around that in the water, there were swamp rats there. I think through the 70s they decided to become the Bomaderry Tigers because they thought the name Bomaderry Swamp Rat wasn't great. Again, there was a resistance, and now they had turned back and used the name Bomaderry Swamp Rats again, which I'm really happy about.
Did you have team colours? What were the colours, do you know?
Yeah, we were just, Bomaderry was just blue and gold. We used to play Nara quite a bit. The Nara people sat on one side, Bomaderry people sat on the other side, and we wouldn't mix.
Tell me about your relationship with Maru. Was there dairy? Well, there was dairying going on in Bowalong. On the swamp?
Yeah.
Did you see the dairies?
Oh, yeah, because my cousin's ex-husband, Bill Schofield, his name's come up before, he used to go out and pick up the milk, in the trucks. And myself and their kids, he used to put us in the back of the truck, frowned upon today, and we used to ride around the farms while he picked up all the milk cans and took them back to the Nara Dairy Company, and that was fun. I used to spend a lot of time out at my auntie and uncle's, Les and Roni Vaughan. I used to spend a lot of time out at their property, which was next door to Pat Muller's. Spend a lot of time on the dairy farms.
How many? Was that in Fletcher's Lane?
They were in Fletcher's Lane first, and then they bought the neighbouring property, which was next to Pat Muller's or Albert Muller's.
Did you know names of the farmers when you were on the milk run, or you were just having fun?
We were just having fun.
Yeah. And what were the roads like?
Oh, again, they were all gravel. You'd travel to Berry on the highway. You'd never, ever go up any of those roads, you know, Pestles Lane. And they just went on forever to this farm, to that farm. And, I think as a small kid you would have got lost real quick. But, they were sort of areas that you know, a lot of people in town especially would never go out there. you know, even if we, I used to go shooting with the local paper shop owner, and we used to, we'd pull up at Maru there on the highway, and he had a Volkswagen with the roof cut off for delivering papers, and we would shoot rabbits from the highway. So again, you just couldn't do that sort of thing these days.
Is there anything more you want to say about the milk factory?
Yeah, it was a big place, and you know, like the only other industry in those days, there was, like I said, the paper mill that was big, but the Narra Dairy Company was big, and probably the product they become most famous for, and I think they still use it today, is their dairy custard. They won a lot of awards. The local industry sort of fell apart as far as the milk factory. This dairy custard seemed to move on through whoever owned the name of the original factory. They kept on making that custard, and I think they still use the same recipe, but I've tasted it, and it doesn't seem to taste as good as it used to when it came from the Narra Dairy Co-op. They also made a lot of yogurts, and they were really popular, real fruit yogurts. So again, like I said before, if you didn't do it good, you didn't survive, and Narra Dairy Company did it good.
So when were they introducing those new products around?
Yeah, oh, that would have been in the 70s, because before it was milk and butter. I think the butter industry fell apart when we started eating margarine. You know, all of a sudden, butter's no good for you. So the butter industry, yeah, as it's turned out, now we're back eating butter and margarine's not good for you. But they took a dive with the butter. So they had to start looking at other products.
And other equipment would have changed if they're adding fruit to yogurt?
Yep. And the big thing with flavoured milk, they did well with that with the introduction, I think, of the Move product, the brand Move. That was the milk Coke, if you know what I mean.
And that was made there.
Yeah. They and other factories, but this badging and labelling of Move milk was a huge thing, you know. And you know, there was ads on TV with kids at the beach, and that was the cool drink to drink. And yeah,
the expansion of the consumer product.
Yeah, that's correct.
You got an apprenticeship.
I could never imagine that I would have been so highly involved in the dairy industry as I grew up. I was lucky enough, my dad knew this electrician, again, in his bulb through the milk factory, a guy in Bury called John Martin. And John, he was a specialist farm-type electrician, and he had the qualifications in commercial refrigeration with these milk vats. So I started my apprenticeship with him. I'm not too sure. I probably spent about 15 years with him.
How old were you when you started?
17. It was the best time ever, because I got to come and work in Bury, forgetting about the job, but I got to know everyone in Bury. And it got to that point, because I worked here for that long, I felt like a local. I could walk down the main street of Bury, and you know, I knew the Waddells and Bill and Beryl Bramley, Daryl Atkins, Rudd Hollins. It just goes on and on and on. The Dones with the bank, Mrs. Mills, the hairdresser. But our workshop was very, very close to the main street. So my job was going out onto the dairy farms and doing electrical work for dairy farms. Every farmer in Bury, every farmer in Gerringong. And eventually, as time went on, and we did a lot of farms in the Narra, Bomadoo, Maru area, and then eventually...
what about Tarara and Noomba?
Yeah, a lot of them, yeah. And as time went on and eventually moving forward a long time, I ended up with every farm from Kembla Grange down to south of Ulladulla towards Maria, out to the coast, out to the highlands towards Goulburn. So, yeah, we talk about this local area, but there was dairy farmers all over the place. So,
If push came to shove and we had some maps, could you nut out some of those names and size of properties?
Yeah, I don't know about the size. Oh, well, I could tell you who were the major dairy farmers because of the size of their milk vats.
Well,
and that was my specialist, you know.
Let's talk.
Well, the big ones were, say, David Boyd. David Boyd would be still one of the biggest producers in Australia.
And where's he located?
He's down there at Tarara. And then on the, you had Cal Crafts, which became Alex Cochrane and his brother Ian. They were huge suppliers. You had down in Jindiandy Lane, you had people like Rodney Crawford, you had the Cochranes, the Wattses. They were all major producers down at Milton. People like Lyle Ewan. Yeah, they were. They all had silo milk vats. And
thinking of your work, where are you located? Literally, where is your workplace?
The workshop was opposite the Great Southern Pub there in a little old building. I think it's an arts place now. I was responsible for every milk vat. So around Berry, we also did the work for the Berry Co-op. All the work in the co-op itself. As time went on, I did work at Narrow Co-op. The other co-ops right up Albion Park, Jamboree, Jarangong. So, yeah.
When you say work, tell me what your work
is. Okay. So it was more industrial electrical work. You know, in other words, the pumps and all the wiring and controls, the refrigeration, keeping things cool, some working on some of the refrigerated trucks. So that's what we mainly did in the milk factories themselves, basically keep them going. I mean, in things like lighting and, you know, extra light, security. And
so on site at the farms, what are you doing? Who's providing you with equipment, are you saying?
Yeah. We worked along with people like Arthur Morehouse. Morehouses were the machinery people, or they used to call themselves, the Alfa Laval product and that. So they put the milking machines in, the milk pumps, and that, and we'd run the power to the motor that drove it. We did all the lighting, the automatic feeders. In other words, eventually as the farms got bigger, they got these feeders that used to cut in and cut out and drop feed for the cow. So we used to connect all them. And the big part, which was our other specialty, which was away from the electrical, was the milk vats, looking after refrigeration. So that was a really responsible job because it was important for us to keep that milk, because when the milk goes in, when it's quite warm, 90 degrees Fahrenheit, you've got about 2 hours for it starts to go off. We were always on call. Even when my old boss John had the business, we'd take turns of getting out to these farms as quick as we could with all the equipment. And we used to have spare compressors and motors and thermostats and all the equipment that makes these things go, and we'd get these tanks.
So you've got to cool the milk down.
Exactly right, exactly. And that was our job. Yeah, installing them, running all the pipe work, installing the refrigeration gas. So we always had quantities of that with us. And we worked along with the farmers. So farmers worked 7 days a week without a day off. This business worked 7 days a week without it. And like the vets, they were out there with us. And we worked along. I've helped deliver plenty of calves with the vets. And, because they'd have a difficult delivery and used to be a bit of an emotional thing, you know, hoping these little calves would start breathing and that.
What are you driving? And did that change?
Oh, we were driving these horrible combis, and my boss was a combi freak, and I hated them. They were underpowered. They were boiling hot in summer, freezing cold in winter. They were terrible, terrible cars, but my old boss, he was a Volkswagen man. But, eventually we swapped and we went to Toyota Hiaces and things that were a little more powerful and comfortable.
And what are you wearing? Just the usual?
Yeah, just the work clothes and overalls and, that sort of thing.
Anything memorable stand out, like really problematic that, I mean, I'm sure it's all that, but was there any major?
We treated every problem like that, and that's why we were the only people on the coast that did this work. It was so important to the farmers. The farmers, and this is later on when my wife, Rhonda, and I had the business.
Well, let's talk about that. So John Martin sold you the...
Yeah, he sold me the refrigeration part. After my first month, if I knew how hard it was, I never worked out how hard running a business, and especially things like cash flows. But, yeah, Rhonda and I...
Okay, I'll slow you down there. So you and Rhonda got married where?
Yeah, we got married in Nara at the Anglican Church in 1980.
And so when are you buying the business?
Probably early 90s, yeah.
And how old were you then?
Around 30.
Yeah, we're all good and fit then, aren't we?
Yeah. This was before computers, so I had this thing where the only way I could work out, I thought if I kept working, we won't go broke.
So I didn't stop working. So I had no other way of working out how our business was going. So we just...
How did you handle that? I mean, that you're going crazy, aren't you?
Oh, it was tough. It was tough. And it wasn't till years later I said to Rhonda, I said in that first part, I said, I called in. Carl got home around 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. She was sitting at the dining room table with a manual typewriter doing invoices. I went in to tell her that I wanted to give up the business and I couldn't do it anymore. I was mentally and physically exhausted. And I told her some years down the track about it and she said, I wanted to do the same and I saw you come in from work and I couldn't do it to you. Lucky we didn't have that conversation, otherwise we might have pulled the pin. But we kept going. The business was quite successful, to be honest, and... You know, and they used to say to me, oh, you know, you're good at what you do. And this, I said, no, I said, it's Rhonda and I. And Rhonda's business management was the success of our business. So I kept working, doing what I was doing. She did what she was doing.
She got the money in.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, she was good at what she was Commonwealth Bank trained, and that really, really helped. It was funny because the dairy industry was in a decline. So I said to Rhonda, in us buying the refrigeration business, I said, that'll give us 2 or 3 years before the dairy industry's pretty well buggered, but that'll give me 2 or 3 years to build up an electrical business. But I didn't know the dairy industry was about to change. The dairy industry grew, farmers got bigger, we started basically from one farm to another replacing their milk vats because the guys got smaller. The work they did on the farm, they were producing more milk. Herds become better.
It was science.
Exactly. And there was incentives out there for the farmers to work hard and produce a lot of milk. The big thing was the Friesian cows, they'd improved the amount of milk that was coming from the cows. So all of a sudden these farmers needed a bigger milk tank. Basically went from the whole South Coast over the Southern Tablelands. We went to every farm, went to a silo, which is the vertical type tank, so that the farmers could hold more milk. And then they become self-cleaning. And then the milk factory started picking up 24 hours. So we'd get call-outs. I still remember Jenny Crawford ringing me at 2 o'clock and said, oh, Ian, the tank's been emptied, but the self-cleaning won't work. So at 2 o'clock, and I'd be out in the vehicle. Because that tank had to be cleaned. They weren't a tank you could watch manually.
Because they're stainless steel. And they're big.
They're huge. They're huge. And they were a silo. They had to be washed automatically. So, yeah, I'd get out there and have the equipment and get it going. And with the growth of that business and the farms, all those farmers, and again, because of our relationship with them, it was like having 150 new friends. And we'd become very close to all these farmers. We inherited some milk factories like Gerringong. I already had Berry. I was doing some work at Nara was still operating then.
What about Jamboree?
Jamboree, yeah, I spent a lot of time at Jamboree. It was a guy called Jeff Boxall was the manager there. He was a really, really nice guy. And Jamboree was famous with their condensed milk. I used to love working there because I always bring a jar of condensed milk home with me and I'd walk along and when they were bottling and canning the condensed milk, the thing was taps were always leaking, so you could walk along and there was a big drip of condensed milk and you just put your finger there and that was all right for the first hour, but at the end of the day you were feeling quite unwell. But
did you whack a bit of weight on?
I did in those days. But I don't know whether that was that or the red wine, but yeah, Albion Park, I looked after Albion Park as well. So it was the first one to close down.
Then what era?
That was in the mid to late 80s. We'll see Albion Park, all Dapto, all that area, a lot of farmers went out. Yeah, it's become suburbia. Houses spread out there.
The land became more valuable.
Yeah, valuable, that's correct. Yeah, yeah. And, but there were still some farmers going and They were transporting to Nara. Yeah, again, I used to go out there and look after all those farms too as well. Before we set up business, I was Jeff Boxall, the manager from Jamboree, ended up managing Narra, and he offered me a job full-time working over a weekend. I made a decision not to take it, which was probably the best decision of my life for a lot of reasons. One of them is I couldn't imagine being working in one building all the time. With my job, I could travel out and work, and I could pull in at Oven Kangaralli beside a stream and put my feet in the water and read a newspaper and have lunch. And what a great place and what a great job. Instead of being trapped in four walls where I would have been if I was in Narra.
You would have had a few weather events to handle, getting across rivers and things, wouldn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah.
Creeks?
Yeah. And it's dangerous, really dangerous, especially Watermulla. I remember one of our customers up there, he went across a tractor, grandkids, and there was two or three of them, lost their lives. The paper mill, they had a double-decker bus. They'd take that up to the Bomberoo Basketball Stadium, and all the paper mill workers would get on that bus and they'd drive that through the floodwaters down to the paper mill. You talk about Pat Muller, Richard Boxall, talking about the 68 fires, I think it was. And this is, again, before I was in the dairy industry. Where we lived in Dalbar Street, I would sit on the back veranda at night, and I was probably nine. I thought it was great, but I didn't realise how serious it was. To see, and we had a great view from our backyard of Canberra Mountain, to see Canberra Mountain alight. And the thought these days, and a few years ago, and when it was on New Year's Day or Eve, down around here where those fires went through there again, and luckily the wind changed and took it up to the Highlands, not good for them. I had these memories of when I was a kid, and I knew what it could do, and I knew what houses are built up and people living in there. I truly thought the westerly wind had come down on the mountain. There would have been a lot of houses lost, and it would have threatened Bomberoo.
Is it a family business still?
Yeah, that's correct. It was when PC started coming in with computers, with networking computers. Years ago, I got involved. I've always, because of my training in control circuit wiring, I was always involved in high-end type stuff. So I started working for some of the government organisations running coax cables for these computers. And then there was a convention that came out called the PC. And so everyone could sit around with their own little computer and they were networked back to a server. So I did training and with some of the employees, and we started running data cables and networking computers. So our business went to a different side, and we also got involved in automation. Now, we were still running the refrigeration business then, and it just got too big. So we sold the refrigeration business off. The best part of that was I didn't have to work 7 days a week. I missed my friends, the dairy farmers, but I didn't miss the seven days, 365 days a year working. So, yeah, our business changed more into automation and computer cabling networking. Eventually, it got bigger. My son and my daughter-in-law bought our business, and that allowed me to retire early and take up my real love of travelling Australia in the outback areas. And basically for the last 10 years we've been travelling in remote areas of Australia, Rhonda and I, in the cooler months of winter, because that's the only time to go in those areas.
Thank you, Ian. I really enjoyed our conversation. This brings us to the close of episode 7. Check out my website in a few days if you want to catch a few photos, therese.sweeney.com.au. I've also just gone to YouTube, and in coming months we'll have some moving image. All the episodes to date are available also on YouTube. Tune in to episode 8 in a few weeks, Turner's Lane, with the Walsh family. Thank you very much for listening. And I hope you're enjoying it. Tell your friends. Just simply Google the Dairy Lane Project. Bye-bye.